eyelids was dusted with freckles. Issa's voice was low and rich when he said, "Pleasure." Mikey said, "You guys are in Pennsylvania, right? How long was the drive?" Lynn said, "Jim Thorpe's the name of the town. Should be 5 hours, but the snow slowed us down." "Left at," she glanced down at her watch, then up at Issa, 5:30 this morning?" Issa said, 5. Couple stops along the way." Mikey said, "Issa, have you been to the area before?" Issa nodded. "Twice." Mikey was glad he had rehearsed easy points of small talk. The drive, weather, traffic, location of restrooms, if needed. However, he hoped that in his efforts to be calm and composed, he did not seem aloof. Lynn explained, "We've been back here to visit my mom a couple times, but it's more often that she comes to us. She loses her mind over the Museum of Mason Jars in the next town over from us. You think I'm joking? She has to take the 90-minute tour every time she visits. Last time she went, she picked up a job application for me." Issa corroborated this with a nod. "And one for me, too," he said. Mikey laughed. He said to Issa, "Lynn has told me, but I can't remember. Where are you from, before Pennsylvania?"
"New York before that. Addis Ababa before that."
"Is that Ethiopia?"
Issa nodded.
Mikey said, "How do you like the snowy Northeast?"
Issa said, "I don't. But Lynn's got this stuff in her blood."
He turned to Lynn and brushed a little bit of snow from her hair, then placed a long arm around her.
"Says she'd lose her mind without winter."
Lynn said, "True. It's the only good excuse to live the way I like." Mikey said, "How do you mean?" "Go to bed early," Lynn explained. "Spend all day in blankets, watch Law and Order for 10 hours straight, eat soup from a can. All the things I love to do. But you act like that in the summertime, and everybody thinks you're off your meds."
Issa said, "She hibernates like a bear."
Mikey laughed. "Lynn, are you still playing piano?" Lynn nodded. Although, she held out her left hand to display that she was missing her left ring finger. Completely gone, down to the fist. Some puckered scar tissue gathered at the top of the metacarpus. Mikey said, "I don't think I knew about that. Did you ever mention it in an email? When did it happen?" "Long story," Lynn said. "I'll tell you later." She hesitated as she lowered her hands to her thighs. Pale skin stretched tight over her clavicles. She tucked hair behind her ears and said, "Did you see this coming?"
"What's that?"
Lynn nodded in toward the sanctuary.
"Sally."
"No," Mikey said.
"Did you?"
"Didn't see it coming," Lynn said. "But I felt it coming. Or heard it coming, I guess I should say."
"What do you mean?"
"I've been working on improv sets, practicing with old jazz trio recordings," Lynn explained. "The days leading up to her suicide, every time I sat down to play, the music that came out of me was wrong, ugly, oppressive. I couldn't make sense of it until I got this news. It's like some part of me that I don't even know knew."
Chapter 6. Lynn started taking piano lessons with her cousin Amy when she was 4 years old. Amy had taught Lynn her left from her right and the first 7 letters of the alphabet before Lynn learned these things in school. One of Lynn's earliest memories was of Amy at her side on the padded piano bench, smelling of cigarettes and vanilla mint perfume, and Lynn's own discovery that if she plunked down on enough keys at one time, using both full palms and strength from her upper arms, this noise was powerful enough to drown out the sound of her parents hurling insults at one another in the next room. Lynn would practice for hours a day, composing her own songs after she had mastered the repertoire from her most recent lesson. Her parents did not push her in this direction, nor did they discourage it. It was entirely her own love of the instrument that inspired this level of discipline. They divorced when Lynn was 7, and her father moved to Pittsburgh to work for a sports broadcasting radio network. By the time Lynn was 8, she had surpassed Amy's skill level. So she started taking lessons from the woman who played piano for their church's contemporary praise group. Lynn's mother had started attending church in the wake of the divorce, and brought Lynn to services every Sunday and Wednesday. Her mother sang way too loudly in services, and raised her hands in worship at times when Lynn did not think it was necessary or appropriate. Lynn organized piano recitals for herself, and invited the Gunners to her home. Her mother would pour red punch into wax paper cups and serve store-bought cookies on a plastic silver tray. Lynn would wear the nicest dress she owned. The other 5 children would seat themselves on folding chairs Lynn had arranged in a semicircle around herself, and they would listen quietly as she played, then applaud when she had finished. Oftentimes, one of the other children would sit at Lynn's piano bench afterward and paw clumsily at the keys, trying to locate a tune. Lynn would laugh and try to teach them something simple. Chopsticks, Heart and Soul. At these times, Lynn felt that her friends were the best friends in the whole world. She dreamed that one day she would play on a huge stage, like Carnegie Hall, and be presented with an award and given the opportunity to speak, and she would thank each of the Gunners by name for their friendship and support. When Lynn was 13, the teacher from church recommended her to a teacher at Buff State. She said Lynn was playing at an advanced level and would not find an adequate teacher outside of the university setting. So Lynn started taking weekly lessons with Brent, a tall, slim graduate student from Texas who wore wire-rimmed glasses and his long hair in a single braid down his back. He smelled a little bit like a horse on hot days, and he sucked on butterscotch candies. When Lynn met Brent, she felt a painful, shivery yearning in her little body. It wasn't that Lynn had no interest in her own peers. She was deeply invested in her friendships with the Gunners, but they were like siblings to her. There was nothing even resembling sexual attraction there. And outside of the Gunners, Lynn cared nothing for her classmates or other kids her age. She didn't need them. She barely even noticed them. But what she felt instantly for Brent sent her careening after something entirely new, something mega. Lynn wanted sex things. At the age of 13, she wasn't even entirely clear on the logistics, but she knew that's what she wanted. She felt desire everywhere, most of all in the zoom between her legs, a vibration so fierce it panted and howled against the crotch of her pants. Life in between her piano lessons became practically unbearable. Lynn could think of nothing else. Inwardly, she hurtled between euphoria and utter despair. She spent long sessions every evening contemplating her outfit for her upcoming lesson. She started to shave her legs. She started to massage her little boobies, having read in 17 magazine that this would make them grow faster. She tried to control her wild red curls with pins and a straightening tool and waxy pomade. The Gunners were routinely swiping liquor from their parents, parents' guests, older siblings, and occasionally beer from the 7-Eleven when the sweaty, nearsighted guy was the only one working. Lynn took small canteens of her mother's gin to the Gunner house once or twice a month. More often than this, and more often than she liked to admit, Lynn was sipping from these canteens on her own. Sometimes to make a long day at school less tedious, or to make the Christian network that her mother watched in the evenings straight up hilarious. Sometimes for no reason at all except the simple fact that, when she was sneaking sips of booze, she felt, quite frankly, the way a person was supposed to feel. It was like an on button. Lynn started to sip before her lessons with Brent, too, realizing that it made her more clever and more confident. It made her playing less precise, but more colorful. They were about 6 months into their lessons when Brent announced to Lynn and her mother that he had been accepted into a PhD program in Cleveland and would be leaving town in May. It was April. Lynn was gutted. She asked her mother how far away Cleveland was. At the first lesson after learning that Brent would be leaving, Lynn waited for her mother to leave the room. Then, instead of starting into the passage that she was supposed to play, Lynn wiped her wet palms together and into her thighs. She opened her mouth to reveal herself to Brent. She had meticulously planned out her exact message and imagined that she would reach the end and Brent would say, "Lynn," wondrously, as though she were a mirage, his eyes shining. He would say, "Oh, Lynn, yes." But now her message was a collection of words swimming aimlessly in her head, her whole script gone as loose and watery as old jello. "Too young, but love, I know, I want, Cleveland, please." Brent stopped her after she had spoken only a single word. "I," with a hand in the air between them. He adjusted his glasses and said, "Lynn, stop. I know you think you know what you want, but you don't."
"What?"
Lynn's voice sounded to her own ears like a tiny toy. The wild heat between her legs instantly went cool, and then dead. "You think you want me," Brent said directly but not unkindly. Then he lowered his voice and added, "And I can smell booze on your breath, young lady."
"Young lady?"
Lynn threw her hands to her cheeks and began to cry immediately, mangled by shame. She shrieked insults at herself inside her head, as though there were two Lynns, one that was completely reasonable and knew all along that she was a child, and of course Brent saw her that way too, and another one that was so stupid it actually thought Brent might share her feelings, the attraction. She couldn't believe she had let the stupid one edge out the smart one. She couldn't believe the smart one had let this happen.
"How could you be so stupid?" she screamed at both of them.
Brent retrieved a Kleenex and said, "You're going to get over this sooner than you think. I promise. But take care of yourself, okay? You're an incredible musician already. It'd be a shame if anything got in your way. If you got in your own way." He helped Lynn compose herself before her mother returned. But when she did, Brent announced that there had been a change of plans and he would be leaving town earlier than anticipated. That today had been their last lesson. Several weeks later, Lynn started taking lessons from another graduate student at Buff State, a female Brent had recommended. Lynn forgot about her feelings for Brent soon after he left. He was right. She recovered from the humiliating incident quicker than she could have imagined. But she did not forget the feelings within herself that had been awakened. She began to explore her own body in private, especially after she'd had a few sips of gin, because alcohol heightened the electrifying sensation that when she touched between her legs, she was powerless against her own power. She began to wonder about the boys who were her friends, Jimmy and Sam and Mikey. She wondered if they had pubic hair yet, and what their lips were like, and if their penises got hard when they thought about her or Alice or Sally. And she even wondered about the girls. She wondered what Sally's slim body looked like without clothing, if those tiny breasts looked like breasts. She wondered what everyone around her was wondering. Chapter 7. Issa went to seek out a restroom before the service began, and Mikey observed Lynn as she reached up with her left hand to push red curls back from her face. Her belled sleeve fell loosely from wrist to elbow as she did this, exposing a little knot of waxy white scar tissue on her left inner forearm. Mikey tried to avert his eyes and suppress the pained twinge of deep discomfort, a vicarious instinct that always, for whatever reason, hailed from his groin. Lynn had never gone into detail about her personal problems in her emails to the others over the years. Mikey recalled that an injury in Lynn's early 20s had prevented her from pursuing the piano competitively, and although she never fell completely out of touch, there were a few years when her emails were less frequent and less coherent, often containing some weirdly banal and cliched message that she presented as deeply profound. Dance like no one is watching. You have to look through rain to see the rainbow. In recent years, Lynn was not bashful about her current role in leadership with AA, but it was clear that she hadn't wanted to provide the others with so much as a glimpse into her troubles until they had been sorted out. Fortunately, Lynn's attention was elsewhere as Mikey's eyes darted to and from her scarred forearm. She was gazing out over Mikey's shoulder and cheerily announced, "Sam Jam!" Mikey followed Lynn to greet Sam at the coat rack. Sam was ginormous. His blonde hair had gone wispy at the crown. He wore a dark brown polyester suit, and a seam at his left shoulder had burst. His belly was a barrel. He looked puffy, kind, sad, and distracted. The pores on his nose were cavernous. His pink face cracked into a smile as he hugged his old friends. Sam's face had always worn emotion oversimplified, as plain as a puppet's. Mikey felt tears blistering beneath his eyelids. Seeing the faces of both Lynn and Sam for the first time in over a decade filled him with longing and joy and some type of uncanny despair. It occurred to him, too, in that same moment, and with nearly the same measure of despair, that he could not recall the last time he had been touched by another person. Lynn said to Sam, "Did you drive all this way?" Sam nodded. "Justine, sorry to miss it," he said. "She was gonna come, but wasn't feeling up to it in the end." Mikey said, "You drove all that way by yourself. You're south of Atlanta, aren't you?" Sam said, "Got 10 hours in yesterday. Stayed in Ohio last night. Only about 5 hours on the road this morning." "Where'd you stay in Ohio?" "Heck of a motel," Sam said. "Just outside Cincinnati. Place was decorated like a boat. The whole motel, I mean. Just like a big cruise ship from the outside. And the inside? The room's all done up like a little cabin. Lifesaver things hung on the wall. The shower curtain, like, what's the word? Nautical pattern. Seashells on everything. Neat." "You wouldn't believe the continental breakfast either. Waffle iron. You make your own." Sam clapped his hand over Mikey's shoulder. "How's life in Lackawanna?"
"It's good," Mike said.
"Your pop still on Ingram?"
Mikey nodded.
"Same house and everything."
Sam said, "You see much of him?"
"Every Sunday," Mikey said.
"Not my favorite part of the week," he added.
Mikey knew that his childhood friends had always feared and disliked his father, who never raised a hand against any of them, but who bristled noticeably at their presence in his home, spoke roughly to them. And there was always that vague smell of blood, blood beneath his father's fingernails, the suggestion of violence.
"How long are you in town?" Mikey asked Sam.
"I'll have to hit the road tomorrow morning. Got work Tuesday."
Sam's lips were the same color of the flesh surrounding them. Lynn said,
"Us too."
Sam said, "Awful nice of Jimmy, inviting us to the house for dinner in the night. Shame about his flight."
Mikey said, "Sounds like if they get him on the next one, he'll get in at Buffalo Niagara around 7, out to the house by 8. Lynn said, "Anybody know how Sally's mom is doing?" Mikey shook his head.
"Don't think I've seen her yet today. Not 100% sure I'll know her if I do."
What was her name? Sam said softly.
Karen?
Corinne.
Alice had made a crack about Sally's mother once when they were young, pointing out to the others that Corinne looked the way grapefruit juice tastes. She wasn't wrong, but Jimmy had jumped all over her for it, even though Sally wasn't present at the time. He said, "Don't do that. Sally's sensitive." Alice had snorted defiantly, but she hadn't brought it up again, at least not that Mikey could recall. Lynn leaned forward. Her voice was a whisper, and it vibrated when she said,
"Corinne mentioned depression in the obituary remarks, right?"
Mikey had finished his coffee, and he dug fingernail crescents into the lip of the styrofoam cup.
He said, "Seems that way."
Sam said, "No note, though."
Lynn said, "Sam, are you doing okay?"
Sam said,
"Still reeling, but..."
An organ had begun to play inside the sanctuary, and Issa had rejoined them. Lynn said,
"Should we go in and grab a seat?"
The four of them filed into a pew. Mikey felt his whole body go languid and loose as a wrung-out rag the moment he sank into a seated position. He had slept poorly the night before, fitfully, waking many times with a dry throat and racing heart and the sensation that he had been panting and running like hell through his dreams, but not sure if he had been running toward something or away from it. Next to him, Sam smelled of a hair too much cologne and stale sweat, presumably from a previous occasion when he had worn this same suit. Chapter 8. Sam introduced the others to Blackout when he was 12. He'd been taught the game by his weird older cousin, Marcus. Marcus spent several weeks at Sam's house every summer because he was a freak whose own parents couldn't stand him, or at least that's what Sam's mother always said before Marcus arrived and after he had left. Marcus had left town that afternoon, and Sam pulled the mattress to the center of the floor in the Gunner house that evening, announcing that he was going to teach them Blackout.
"You make yourself pass out," Sam explained. "I've been doing it all week with my cousin. It's the biggest high. It's really scary."
Jimmy said, "How do you do it?"
"You get on your hands and knees like this."
Sam moved to the center of the mattress and crouched on it, his big bottom balanced on his ankles.
"Then you hyperventilate 100 times.
He demonstrated this now, whooshing breath in and out vigorously.
"And then you do this, like you bear down like you're taking a poo, go really tight in your head."
Sam did this for a moment, his face quickly going red.
"Then you're out. You have like a crazy dream, like a super vivid, realistic dream, and wake up in a minute and have no clue where you're at for a little bit."
Alice said, "Sounds pretty friggin' stupid to me." Alice was already out of sorts that night. Earlier in the day, Jake had pissed all over her collection of New Mutants comic books, so the pages were soft and smelled like pee, and the colors were all bleeding together. She had spread them out all over the floor of the Gunner house in the hopes that they might be salvageable once dry. Sam said,
"Screw you. It's actually, like, really cool, Alice. You just don't want to like it because it's my thing."
Mikey said, "It sounds scary. Does it make your brain go bad?"
Sam gave Mikey a condescending look.
"Make your brain go bad? No, it doesn't make your brain go bad."
Jimmy offered, "Well, it probably kills a bunch of brain cells." Alice smirked in Sam's direction.
"That would explain a lot."
Sam struggled the most of all of them in school, barely passing classes and stuttering like a broken lawnmower when asked to read aloud.
He said, "Screw you, Alice,"
and glanced around the room to see how others were responding to the dig. Lynn said,
"I'll try it."
Although Lynn was usually fairly quiet, it was not uncharacteristic of her to be the first to try something. A year earlier, she had been the one to introduce alcohol to the group,
filling a canteen with her mother's gin while her mother napped one afternoon, and delivering it triumphantly to the gunner house that evening. Sam instructed Lynn once again. Try to remember your dream. The other children watched as Lynn crouched on the mattress and began to hyperventilate. She was wearing jeans and a tie-dyed tank top. Her forehead was drizzled with a trail of acne beneath the red curls. The sound of her labored breath began to disturb Mikey, and he tried to think of other things. Then Lynn sat upright and closed her eyes. Her face and neck went tight, and several seconds later, everything went very soft. She fell back onto the mattress, wearing a blank and peaceful expression. The others watched in silence. After a bit, Sally said, "Should we wake her?" Sam said, "She'll be up soon." Mikey felt afraid. "Is she breathing?" he said. "Yes, duh," Sam said, although he didn't seem entirely certain. Soon enough, Lynn's eyes fluttered open. She rose and stared around the room. She blinked. She gave a quick smile and said, Sam said, "I told you guys so. I told you guys it was cool." Alice said, "What was it like?" Mikey said, "Was it like you were dead?" "No," Lynn said. She was quiet for a bit. Then she said, "It was like I was alive then, and I'm dead now." Sam said, "See, you guys, I told you." Sally said, "What did you dream?" Lynn said, "I dreamed I was playing a concert on a big stage. And that guy from school who comes to fix the vending machine when your chips get caught, you guys know who I mean, right? He always smells like KFC. Anyway, he was my page-turner, sitting next to me on the piano bench. And in the dream, I think he did not smell like KFC. But anyway, I was wearing a black velvet dress." Lynn's face was bright and animated as she recalled the dream. It was so real. She turned to Sam. "You're right. It was the realest dream I've ever had." Sam said, "Who's going to go next?" There was a brief and uncomfortable silence among the rest of them. Alice got up to check the progress on her comic books, then she returned. Mikey said, "Are we having fun? Is this fun?" Alice said, "Why do you always ask that?" Sometimes Mikey felt like he was watching his friends through binoculars, even when they were right before him. Sam said, "Alice, you always say my ideas are stupid. Why don't you actually try it then? Unless you're too scared." "Fine, I'll go, you turd, if it'll get you to shut up." Alice took Lynn's place on the mattress. She was wearing overalls over a wife beater and a backward hat. Mikey wished he were wearing that, too. Instead, he was in denim cut-off shorts and a t-shirt with Garfield on the front and a plate of lasagna on the back. Alice hyperventilated for many counts. Then she rose, clenched her muscles for a brief time, and wilted backward, just as Lynn had minutes earlier. Silence. 30 seconds. A minute. Lynn finally said, "Was I out this long?" Sally shook her head. "I don't think so." Mikey said, "Do you think she's okay?" Sam said, "You guys are such worry warts." It was quiet for a bit. Then Jimmy said, "It has been longer than Lynn, you guys." Lynn said, "Is she breathing?" Sam said, "She's totally fine." Mikey stared at Alice's empty face. He said, "Are you sure?" Jimmy said, "Yeah, are you sure?" Sam leaned over Alice, briefly examined her face, and said sarcastically to the others, "Would you like me to see if she's breathing?" Mikey was scared. He did want to know if she was breathing. Sam said, "Well, okay, fine." He leaned down into Alice's face and put an ear to her mouth.
Alice immediately came to life with a blood-curdling shriek directly into Sam's ear, and he was so startled he fell backward off the mattress, rolling lopsidedly onto the hardwood floor like an egg and panting. Alice sat up, boiling over with laughter. The rest of them began to laugh, too. They laughed and laughed, relieved and jump-scared, tickled by Alice's trick. Lynn said, "But it worked, right? You passed out first, right? Or were you just pretending the whole time?" Alice said, "It did work. When I woke up, I decided to pretend for a little bit to try and scare you guys."
Sally said, "What was your dream when you passed out? Can you remember?"
Alice said, "I did dream. Hang on, let me try to remember." She closed her eyes, and shortly, something dark passed over her face. She said, "Oh," quietly. "Oh." Lynn said, "Do you remember?" Alice nodded.
"What was it?" Mikey said.
Alice didn't respond. Her eyes were still closed.
"What did you dream?" Sally said.
Alice opened her eyes. "I dreamed that something bad happened between us." Sally stared at her.
"Between you and me?"
"Between all of us.
I dreamed that we weren't friends anymore."
It was very quiet for a bit as they all thought about this. Then Jimmy said,
"It was just a dream, Alice."
And she said,
"But it felt so real."
Chapter 9. Inside the sanctuary, it smelled of mildew, cologne, and spent matches. An elderly woman played the organ beautifully, and Mikey stared into his program, which did not contain a photograph of Sally, just the same words that had been offered in her public obituary, several lines of scripture, and the list of funeral service proceedings. Many flower arrangements were lined up across the front of the sanctuary. Massive tiger lilies, bundles of peach roses, pink hydrangeas, a wreath of snow-white roses and mini carnations and cushioned palms and chrysanthemums, pale yellow freesia and alstroemeria. Abruptly, Mikey felt a stiff pinch in his shoulder, near the base of his neck at a nerve, and he squirmed. He turned to see that Alice was settling herself into the pew behind him. He had to crane his neck around fully in order to accommodate the new blind spots in his right eye and get a good look. Alice imitated this gesture, his neck swivel with added panache. Alice had always had a special talent for noticing the things about you that you most wished to hide from the world. How wonderful, Mikey thought, that this quality had carried over into adulthood. She leaned forward to kiss Mikey's hair and ruffle it a bit, and she wrapped her arms around him in a warm hug. Her eyes were dark and bright, her broad, high cheeks flushed, her dark, wavy hair pulled into a loose and messy braid. Mikey judged her to be at least 6 feet tall, which would mean she had grown another few inches after high school. She wore a black turtleneck sweater and navy fleece vest over her broad shoulders. Mikey was very conscious of cat hair on his own clothing. He had several lint rollers, including one in his car. So he could not help noticing now that Alice's dark clothing was covered with little white animal hairs, some of which transferred to his own shoulders when she hugged him. Alice was accompanied by a stunning and younger-looking woman with platinum blonde hair and bright red lips. Alice waved hellos to the others in the bench, and she squeezed Mikey's neck affectionately a second time and said, "Hiya, pal." He patted her hand. "Hi, pal," he said, and fought not to wince under her grip. Moments later, Mikey heard Alice working some piece of gum or candy out of its wrapper behind him. She passed forward a little card with foil packets. "Gum," she whispered. "My breath is always the worst in church, like something deep in my gut just died when it realized where I was." Mikey took the card and was about to help himself to a piece when he noticed that it was Nicorette. He turned to pass the Nicorette back to Alice, and he saw Corinne, who was making her way up the center aisle. She was bent and tiny, a black shawl wrapped fully around her head from crown to chin. Gray cheeks, a feathery pattern of wrinkles at her pale eyes, thin lips straight across and tight, a perfect hyphen. Her posture oddly shaped and off-kilter, like an injured bird. She was closely followed by several more similar-looking older folks who Mikey guessed to be siblings or cousins. Mikey's eyes fell to Alice as Corinne passed, and Alice's face was stretched open with grief, eyes dark. But she shed no tears. It suddenly occurred to Mikey that for all their many years of friendship, he had never once seen Alice Clancy cry. The snowfall had grown heavier throughout Sally's service, and the sidewalk needed to be shoveled once again. A rosy-cheeked kid in a green knit cap and Carhartt overalls was clearing a path from the church to the parking lot. Jimmy had provided everyone with directions to the lake house. He said that normally it would be a 15-minute drive from the church, but it might take about twice that if the forecast was as bad as it looked. He warned them about the steep descent from the road down to the parking area at the house. Sam and Lynn said they were both going to make a quick stop in at their own parents' homes while they were in town, but would be on time for dinner at 6 o'clock. Alice and Mikey would go directly to the lake house. Alice's girlfriend had ducked into the restroom right after the service, so Alice and Mikey walked out to his car together. Salt crunched beneath their feet, and the cold air tasted like metal. When they reached Mikey's car, Alice took him by his shoulders and studied his face for a moment. "You haven't aged a day, you evil son of a bitch," she said. "I never noticed it before, but you look an awful lot like that actor. The younger brother, you know who I mean. The older brother's handsomer, no offense, and more famous. You know who I'm talking about." She stomped her foot impatiently and stared at him with her mouth open, a warm red cave. "Come on, they both have women problems. Older one screwed the nanny, and the younger one got himself in some kind of trouble too, slapped some girls behind or something." Mikey shrugged with his eyebrows. "Anyhow," Alice said, "you look exactly like that younger fella, except that you're blonde and freckled up. Otherwise, you're a dead ringer." She paused to lick her thumb and smooth it over Mikey's cowlick. "And look at me," she said. "Big fat old shitbag. I'm a beast. You know how I know I got fat?" "You're not fat." "Because of your face. Yes, that look right there. Picture paints 1,000 words. Mikey laughed. Alice reached for his glasses. He helped her release them from behind his ears. "When'd you get these?" She put them over her own eyes, squinted, and grimaced. She opened one eye, then the other, and pointed at the right lens. "This one's like looking through the freaking Hubble. How come you have perfect vision in your left eye and you're blind as a bat in the right?" "Other way around. I'm blind in my left eye," Mikey said. "That's why there's no prescription. Only partly blind on the right." Alice took off the glasses and stared at him. "So that's what's up with the snake charmer dance." Alice once again imitated Mikey's neck swivel. "When did this happen?"
"It's always been."
She stared hard into his left eye.
"How did I not know this when we were little?"
"So many people to mock, so little time, I imagine." Alice laughed.
"Don't be mad," she said. "It's my love language."
Alice handed his glasses back to him and gestured toward Mikey's car. "You safe behind the wheel, Mr. One Eye? And you all right in that little Civic? You don't even have tire chains put on. I can drive you to Jimmy's if you want."
"I've been driving this sort of car in this sort of weather for as long as I've been driving, and with only one eye, too."
Alice said, "I need to ask a favor." She reached for Mikey's hand,
took his index finger and guided it to a spot deep at the back of her jawbone where it met her neck.
"I've got a hair," she said. "One thick black one. Grows right out of here. Do you see it? Do you feel it?"
Mikey leaned closer. He said, "It's very short, though. I'm never going to be able to get it with my nails. I'd need tweezers."
"Damn," Alice said.
"Christine refuses to get it for me. I think she thinks it's the loving thing to do, pretend it doesn't exist.
It makes me crazy. I'm like, babe, I know it's there, just pull it out. Instead, I have to wait until it's long enough for me to do myself, and I'm telling you, thing grows like a weed. It'll be an inch long in a week, and half the time I forget about it altogether until it's like a disturbing length."
Alice was quiet for a moment. Then abruptly she let out a single noise that sounded like a sob tucked within a cough. Mikey said, "Are you okay?" He paused. "I could probably get that hair without a tweezers if I really tried." Alice barked out a laugh. "I appreciate you," she said. She shook her head out violently and cough-sobbed again, a wild sort of noise. She said, "I can't believe Sally's gone. I don't know why it still has to feel so... Jimmy sounded so weird when he called me the other day. Like, really weird. It's all very... Anyway, I can't stop thinking." Alice's voice tapered off to silence.
"Me too," Mikey said. It was quiet for a bit.
"I don't know what to say," Mikey said. "What should I say?" Alice sniffed.
"Yo-ho-ho," she said.
She threw her braid over her shoulder. Mikey had always been impressed with Alice's ability to fly in and out of intense emotions without even touching ground. A gust of wintry air hit Mikey's face like a slap.
"It's good to be together now," he said.
Alice stared out over the white landscape for a moment. Smoke rose from the roof of the Chinese-owned laundry down the street. Snowflakes lifted and swirled and danced. The roof of the church was practically in shreds, lashed to pieces by lake-effect storms. Women in thick-heeled pumps and wool coats clutched the black wrought-iron rail while making their way down the steps of the church entryway. People pressed against each other as they exited the church, as though they couldn't escape fast enough. It seemed there were twice as many people leaving the church now than had attended the service itself. And it occurred to Mikey that, outside of his friends, he hadn't seen anyone under the age of 50 at the service.
Mikey said, "It's good to be together now."
"You just said that," Alice said. "I heard you the first time."
"Did I?"
Alice nodded. Mikey knew he had a habit of doing this, often unconsciously. Repeating things he believed to be true. It made him feel safe, sure-footed, gave him a pleasing little jolt. Alice's broad cheeks were flamed red with cold. No makeup surrounded her large black eyes beneath thick black eyebrows that were sharply arched, giving her the look of constant excitement. Mikey said, "How tall are you, anyway?"
6'1". "You want to know how much I weigh, too?"
Alice touched a small pimple on her chin and said, "I can't remember if I put my worms in the fridge."
"Excuse me?"
"I do my own worm picking."
"Worm picking? Like out of the ground?"
"No, out of my butt."
Mikey laughed.
"Okay, but is this something I'm supposed to have heard of?"
"I guess you wouldn't have, not being in the biz. I pick my own worms 'cause the vendors will gouge you," she explained.
"Ah, for your marina." Alice nodded. She ran her finger over the roof of Mikey's car, collecting a fingerful of snow, and she put this in her mouth.
"What does this entail?"
2 to 4 in the morning," Alice said. "Out in the woodlands. That's where you'll find the best colonies. Now, this time of year, traipsing around in the snow, that's a different story. I don't get out near as often. It's such an ordeal. But when it all thaws out, early spring... that's the best time."
"How much do you haul in?"
In one morning?
10 pounds? 15 pounds?
That's all worms? Or some soil, too?
Half and half. You need a fair bit of soil so they don't kill themselves getting all wrapped up in each other. They do that, you know. All that meat and muscle, clamping together till they squeeze the life right out of each other.
Alice clasped her fingers together to demonstrate.
I get it, Mikey said, gently slapping her fingers apart. So you think you left them out and unattended?
I just can't remember is the thing, Alice said.
I think I may have left a cooler full back in storage right next to the water heater.
Maybe I'll call Kevin, have him check.
Is he one of your employees?
Alice nodded.
The one and only. Looks after everything when I'm gone, but he's uppity, though, is the thing. Likes to point out my mistakes. That's why part of me just wants to leave it so he doesn't have the pleasure of fixing my problem, know what I'm saying? I could really go for a big piece of cheese right now. I'm about famished. I just found out I'm lactose intolerant, though. Did I tell you that? It's terrible. I'd have rather found out I have diabetes. At least they get to eat cheese, right? Do they get to eat cheese?
Mikey said, listening to you talk is like... Have you ever tried to ride a bucking bronco?
I haven't, but I imagine...
Bronco? No way. But I have tried to ride one of those fake bulls in a dive bar, Alice said.
They're not meant for people my size.
Alice scooped more snow from the roof of Mikey's car and ate it. Alice's girlfriend was walking out of the church, and Alice waved her over. The young woman smoothed her hair and breathed into her fists as she jogged their way, though the high heels on her black leather boots slowed her down considerably. Alice said to Mikey,
"This is Chris."
"Yes," she added with a wry grin, "believe it or not, she dates me." Chris was wearing a fitted black leather coat and black leather gloves and a very expensive-looking green scarf. She extended her hand to Mikey. Her bright lipstick had worn off a bit and was faded unevenly. Her hair was like white silk, eyes a pale goldish hazel, teeth very straight and very white. She looked like $1 million. But the sort of pretty... that was so pretty it was disappointing. You wanted a raised mole, a gap in the teeth.
Mikey shook her hand.
Chris said, "And you must be..."
Her voice was so unexpectedly shrill that Mikey had to conceal a grimace.
Alice cut in.
"For crying out loud, Chris, this is Mikey, of course. I've told you about him 1,000,000 times. He's always been my favorite, and I've always been his."
Mikey laughed.
Alice said, "All right, let's check on old Finny and hit the road."
"Finny?"
"Finn's my husky," Alice explained.
"That's right," Mikey remembered from the emails.
"He's in your car?"
Alice nodded.
"He's from the Arctic, loves the cold, does just fine in this. Got him a pile of wool blankets in the back anyhow. He's 100 years old, and I won't go anywhere without him. And, yes, I cleared it with Jimmy that I'm bringing my old-ass dog to his place. What, you think I was raised in a friggin' barn? Look at me like that."
Mikey said, "I wasn't looking at you any kind of way, Alice."
"Am I annoying you already?" she said.
"Yes."
Alice threw her head back and laughed in big ha's that released thick, puffing clouds into the air before her face, which she waved away with her hand as they evaporated.
"This is making me want a cigarette," she said,
releasing a tight, slow stream through her lips.
Chris gave her a stern look and whined,
"Babe."
Mikey's earholes practically seized up. That voice.
Alice and Chris had been dating for a good little while, so Alice must have made her peace with it, Mikey concluded, although he couldn't quite imagine how. And it would be unlike Alice to make peace with any sort of thing at all.
Alice turned to Mikey. "Chris says smoking takes 7 years off the average lifespan."
Alice made a distasteful face and spat something, or nothing, into the snow at her feet.
"I say so does worrying about things like the average lifespan."
"I'll see you guys over there," Mikey said. "Don't get lost. Jimmy said the driveway's steep and hard to find. Start watching for it soon after you cross the train tracks."
Alice said, "Yo-ho-ho!"
Before Mikey got into his car, he glanced back up toward the church, where Corinne stood at the entrance. She was directing a young man who carried flower arrangements in brown paper grocery bags to her old teal Chevy Chevette. Above Corinne's car, a grackle perched on a telephone pole was chewing out the sky, really laying into it.
Rah, rah, rah! Wah, wah, car, car! Wah, wah, wah!
Chapter 10. Mikey's father left for work at 7 o'clock every morning, roughly 20 minutes before the bus came by for Mikey. He always woke Mikey before leaving and left a bowl and a box of cereal on the table. Mikey was expected to rinse his dishes and lock the door behind him. If he ever missed the bus, and if he ever missed the bus, he was instructed to let himself back inside and call his father at work. His father would leave work to return and deliver Mikey to school. When this happened, Mikey knew it was better to sit silently on the drive over rather than offer any sort of apology or excuse. It was on one of these mornings when Mikey was 11 years old that diarrhea had delayed him, and he didn't make it out on time. He watched as the bus rounded the corner at the far end of Ingram, the morning sun fierce in his eyes, his bottom still burning, and pursed unpleasantly from his session on the toilet. He turned to go back inside to make the dreaded phone call to his father's workplace when a woman's voice from the sidewalk called, "Hey, you, Barney Rubble." Mikey turned. It was the slim, silver-haired woman, Sally's mother. Although he and Sally had been best friends for years, he had spoken with Sally's mother only a handful of times. Of all the Gunners, Sally's was the only home where they never, ever played. Nevertheless, it surprised him that she didn't know his name. "Barney Rubble," she called out again, approaching with her hand in the air, a sloppy but unthreatening wave. She wore a sheer pale blue garment beneath an unzipped Buffalo Bills hoodie and purple flip-flops. Her silver hair was in some extravagant sort of updo. Mikey waved back, and she approached the porch. "It's Mikey," he said, "not Barney." "I know that," she said. "Give me a little credit. You never seen the Flintstones?" Mikey shook his head. "Well, that makes me sad," she said, although it didn't seem to make her sad at all. "Barney Rubble's a blondie like you," she explained, rumpling his hair with her spidery fingers. "And he wears a shirt that same shade." Mikey's plain brown T-shirt was part of a 10-piece rainbow pack from Kmart. "You miss the bus?" The woman shared Sally's delicate, pretty features, but her skin had an unhealthy sheen, and her teeth were a grayish hue. Within clotted mascara frames, both the iris and white of her eyes seemed too close to yellow. There were tiny threads of blood in the inner corners of her eyes. Mikey nodded. "I'm Corinne, Sally's mom," she said. "I know you know me."
"I do," Mikey nodded again. "I met you before," he said.
"I know," Corinne said.
"You want to ride to school? I've got to head that direction to hit the tanning bed anyway."
Mikey considered this. He had been instructed many times to never, ever get into a car with a stranger. But given his long friendship with Sally, surely this woman could not be considered a threat. Corinne reached out to tug on his shoulder and she said,
"Come on, you can wait inside while I put on pants. Then we'll head on over. We'll probably beat the bus anyhow. They've got to make all those stops."
Mikey took a seat at the kitchen table in the Forrest household and gazed around the room while Corinne disappeared into another part of the house. Dishes were stacked high within the sink and on the counter, food drippings and splatters on every surface. Ant traps and roach traps sat out in plain view. Balled up underwear. The house smelled of garbage and perfume. The TV blared the gleeful meows of a cat food commercial in the next room. There was a plastic bear full of honey on the table, a tiny golden bulb gleaming at its yellow tip. Corinne returned from her bedroom in jeans and a white tank top, with the same purple flip-flops and hairdo. She held a photograph in her hand and gazed at it fondly for a moment before handing it over to Mikey, and she said, "Looky." As Mikey took the photograph, he heard movement and a man's phlegmy cough from elsewhere in the house. Corinne said, "That's Billy. He's trouble." She laughed indelicately, her chin high in the air, then said, "He's harmless." Corinne pointed back down to the photograph in Mikey's hands. The photograph featured a young, silver-haired girl draped over a tire swing and straddling it. She gazed at the camera with pouting, model-like intensity. The girl looked so much like Sally that at first Mikey thought it must be her, but then realized from the fading and softened corners of the photograph that it was an old photograph, and therefore was not of Sally, but of her mother.
"Is it you?" he said.
Corinne nodded.
"Don't we look alike, me and Sally?"
Mikey nodded.
"A lot."
Corinne said,
"We could easy be twins, don't you think? We look so much alike."
Mikey nodded again.
"People tell us that all the time," Corinne said.
A head poked briefly around the corner into the kitchen. Billy's big, pale face was potato-like, slothful and indistinct, completely devoid of curiosity. He said, "Your AC's broke." Corinne said,
"So fix it."
Billy shuffled away, and Mikey heard steps in the bathroom, then a thick torrent of pee. Corinne turned back to Mikey, took the photograph from him, and stared at it under the light with an expression that briefly became complicated. Then she looked back at Mikey and said,
"Do you want to see more?"
Mikey glanced at the clock on the wall. They really needed to leave soon, or he was going to be late. Then the school would call his father, and then he could really be in much more trouble than if he had just called his father right away. Corinne followed his eyes to the clock and said,
"I guess I need to get you to school, don't I? Well, this has been just fine."
Corinne walked Mikey back out to the street, where her Cutlass Supreme was parked. She turned on the radio and headed up Ingram toward Ridge. Mikey wondered what Billy was up to back at the house, if he might do some of those dishes or help take the garbage out. He wondered if Billy was responsible for the mess. Corinne sang along with the Beach Boys, utilizing vibrato on sustained notes and harmonizing with the chorus. She glanced over at Mikey.
"Sally has a great voice, too," she said, "although I don't imagine she ever sings for you."
Mikey said,
"Sometimes really soft."
Corinne was quiet for a bit. Then she said,
"She's your favorite, isn't she?"
Mikey glanced at Corinne.
"She's what?"
"Your favorite. She's the prettiest. You love her. You like her the best."
"Oh."
Yes, Mikey supposed maybe he did love Sally, although not for the reason Corinne had suggested. Not for the way that Sally looked, nor for the fact that she and her mother were practically like twins. If he loved Sally, it was because Sally had been his first friend. Corinne lowered her window, pulled a pack of cigarettes from the center console and lit up, briefly removing both hands from the steering wheel in order to do so. When they reached the school, Mikey could see across the lot that his bus was just pulling in as well. He had made it on time. His father would not receive a phone call. He would not have to endure that silent ride, his father's seething silence. He thanked Corinne for the ride. She was right. This had been just fine. Corinne cheerily lit another cigarette and waved to him through the window once he had gotten out of the car, and she said,
"Make sure you tell your dad what a good driver I am. Toodaloo."
Later that day, Mikey mentioned all of this to Sally, how her mother had offered him a ride, how he'd been in their home, how her mother had shown him a photograph from her own childhood.
Sally looked as if this information might make her cry. So Mikey quickly said, "Your mom is very nice." Sally blinked and stared at Mikey for a moment. Then she said, "I guess she's nice." "Okay." Mikey sensed that Sally did not wish to discuss